this complexity from, biological systems, arts, and so on. But unfortunately, the only examples in physics it kind of gives me is this classical cellular automata. And I played a little bit with this yesterday. So these automata of steel and wolfram, but they basically work, you start from some simple seed, you put on some simple rules for evolution, and then that generates a kind of complexity out of it. Okay. So in this talk, I want to tell you how you can get complexity from such simple patterns when you put quantum mechanics. And the systems where I'm going to discuss that are those arising in the quantum Hall effect. So the basic physical experiment that we do to find these systems is you take a two-dimensional electron gas, you put it in a perpendicular magnetic field, and then you measure a response when you drive a current through that gas. So you measure the conductance along the current and perpendicular to the current, and then you find the two resistances. And this has been done for many years now in a system based on gallium arsenide semiconductors. But in recent years, people have invented graphene, and now we have these new systems where we can essentially study a similar type of physics. And in particular, there's this very, very new material bilayer graphene, where now there are two interesting experiments that find these states. So my talk will be basically in two parts. So the first part will be a broad introduction, but not just old stuff. I will also tell you about some new developments, how to understand these phases of matter from the point of view of entanglement. And then in the second part, I will move to a specific system, bilayer graphene, to tell you what's new there. Okay, so I described the basic experiments, and this is the kind of feature that we get out of it that we want to understand better. So this is the Hall resistance perpendicular to the current you drive through a system as a function of field. And you see that it's non-monotonic. It develops this series of steps. And these steps are very nicely quantized in terms of this number nu, which is the ratio of the electron density to the magnetic field, or the number of electrons to the number of magnetic flux quanta that go through your system. And I want to emphasize that this quantization of the resistance is extremely robust. And I think the best example to illustrate that is by saying that this data I'm showing here is actually the data I took when I was an undergrad student. So, if you have an undergrad theorist who can go into the lab and measure something like that, then how robust must it be? So how do we understand, the physics of these states? Well, as physicists, we like to start from simple things. And we know that, if we turn on if we have zero magnetic field, then we have a Fermi liquid. But when we turn on the magnetic field, then the single particle problem is quite different. So now we have a set of discrete energy levels, which are called Landau levels. And in this talk, so this is the famous, harmonic oscillator solution that we know from basic quantum mechanics. And in this talk, I would just assume that instead of a 2D system, I have a system wrapped along a cylinder. So I will use this expression for the coordinate of electrons on this cylinder. And as you well know, there is a unit of length which naturally emerges in this problem, which is the magnetic length. So the simplest case is how can I get a quantized state? Well, I just take, these single particle states and I completely fill up this band. So in other words, I just make a slate determinant of these. So these are the single particle wave function, which you probably also very well know. So the single particle wave functions are just completely periodic along the perimeter of the cylinder, and they are Gaussians in this other direction of the cylinder. So if I take this cylinder and completely fill it up, so I make a slate determinant of these states, I'm just going to get this very nice van der Waals determinant, and that explains this state. But unfortunately, there are other states here, for example, this one-third state, where I have, as you see, many more fluxes than I have electrons, so there's no obvious sense of completely filling up anything. So how do I explain these states? Well, now we have nice intuition based on Laughlin's work in the early 80s, which actually made a kind of remarkable proposal for the many-body wave function that describes these states. And so this wave function has a nice form in terms of these z-coordinates, but I think it's more intuitive to try to think about it in terms of Hubbard models. So how do we envision this wave function in terms of Hubbard model? So this wave function, really what it tells us is that the fundamental unit of this Laughlin state is some area which encloses exactly three magnetic flux quanta, And in such an area, I can only put a single electron. So I cannot bring other electrons to that same area. And when you make a condensate of such little objects, then you get the Laughlin state. But note that there is no lattice here. So it's not really like we think in terms of Hubbard model. So these are kind of floating around. So these two examples are what people call nowadays topological phases of matter. So just to summarize, so we are talking about gapped many-body states of phases of matter. And if you put them on a special surface like a torus, then you find that their ground state has a non-trivial degeneracy. And also they have very interesting excitations in the bulk. So they have these anions. So if I take this Laughlin state and I make two defects in that state, for example, I create two quasiparticles, then if I use STM tip, I can move these two particles around one another. And I find that what happens with the wave function for that system, so the wave function is going to acquire a phase relative to the original wave function, which is not just minus one, that would be for electrons. So other interesting aspects of physics in these systems is that they are described by Chern-Simons gauge field. And there has been some new development about that, which probably Duncan will tell you later in the week. Again, canonically, we think that these systems are incompressible fluids in the bulk. And we know that they have chiral gapless modes at the edge due to work of Xiaogang. But now there are some new experiments that actually suggest from Weitzman group that suggests that this picture might be more complicated. So there might be intrinsic couplings between the bulk and the edge. So the bulk is also active energetically and so on. So there are these new things which we still need to understand. And also one other important aspect about these systems is that they turn out to have long-range entanglement. So what that means is that if I look at the small, if I cut out the small subsystem of a big system and I look at its reduced density matrix, then I can compute the von Neumann entropy for that reduced density matrix, which is also called entanglement entropy. And what you find is that this, for these systems, the entanglement entropy satisfies this area law, which is, I guess, very famous nowadays. So the entanglement entropy scales as a boundary of your subsystem. And then there is a subleading constant, which characterizes this topological order. So it's related to this phase here and the statistics and so on. So so why are we doing all this? Well, we are interested in these systems. I guess at least a big part of the excitement about them is because of this possibility to have non-abelian anions, not just the simple ones that I shown on the previous slide. And this is primarily related to this state which has a filling factor 5/2. So you go to a higher Landau level and you half fill it. So as you see, there's a beautiful plateau there. And so what could be the possible wave function for that? Well, you could maybe guess that it's just kind of you completely fill the lower Landau levels and then try a Laughlin state in that partially filled Landau level. But that, of course, doesn't work because this wave function is not an electronic wave function. It's even under the exchange of coordinates. However, it was realized in the early 90s that you can actually correct this wave function in a really interesting way by stitching this Pfaffian prefactor to it, which then makes it an electronic wave function. And this then automatically gives you non-abelian anions in the bulk of this phase. So first of all, the ground state of this phase is also described by a simple little droplet, but now this droplet encloses four magnetic fluxes, and it has two electrons inside of it. So there you can already see that there is something interesting because it looks like there's some kind of pairing going on in this state. So now if I create, for example, four defects in such a state, you can show that for this wave function, there are exactly two quantum mechanical states linearly independent that correspond to them, and I call them psi1 and psi2. So now if I exchange these two of these four defects, I actually, and I start, for example, from one of these states, psi1, I don't only end up with psi1, but I also pick up a component on the other state, which I call psi2. So you can see that this system, this minimal system, actually acts like a qubit. And it's a topological qubit because you have this many-body excitation gap, which is protected by topology. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit how we study all this. Well, the primary numerical technique so far to study the systems has been exact Dagnerization. And the recipe for that is, it's extremely simple. So you just take your full many-body Hamiltonian, which in this case is Coulomb interaction, and you have to project it to some partially filled Landau level. But we know how to do that. And actually, there's a really nice form of this Hamiltonian when you project it to a given Landau level in terms of this Haldane pseudopotentials. So this Hamiltonian, when you project it to a Landau level, is basically completely parameterized by a small set of numbers, which are these VMs. And then there is some geometrical object which you don't need to care about. So the whole problem is really reducing to just this discrete set of numbers, which we need to know. And these numbers, they describe the interaction energy of a pair of particles in a state with a given quantum number. Let's say it's angular momentum or something like that. Okay, so now we have this Hamiltonian. So what do we do? Well, we just express it, you know, in a Hilbert space. So we get some huge matrix. And as you see, this is the actual matrix from a simulation. So the white parts are zeros. The red parts are non-zeros. So it's a sparse matrix. And it can be really big. So you put this matrix in your favorite computer, and a lot of stuff comes out of that. Then you can compute essentially whatever you want. So because you get your ground state, which is expressed in terms of all possible slated determinants for that finite system. So that's really simple. It's a very nice method because it's completely unbiased. The accuracy is the accuracy of your computer, so you have 14 digits, so it's great. But there is a limitation. And in fact, there's just one limitation, and that's that the Hilbert space grows exponentially with your system size. So you have to face the question, is what I can do enough to give me the physics of thermodynamic limit? So how many particles is equal to thermodynamic limit? 10, 50, 100, or 1,000? And in these systems, I think I never tire of emphasizing this. The really nice feature is that that number can be as small as 4 in some cases. Okay, so here is what we get when we diagonalize the Laughlin state for 4 particles. So this is the full energy spectrum as a function of momentum. So we see a lot of features here. So the ground state has a zero momentum, so it doesn't break translational symmetry. We see a very nicely resolved collective mode. This mode is called magnetoroton. It was studied in the 80s by McDonald, Platzman, and Gerwin. Then also the numerical value of the gap of that mode is already pretty accurately matching the thermodynamic limit. So in this particular case, there's really a lot of stuff that we can just find out from the system of 4 particles, which is, I think, pretty remarkable for a strongly interacting physical system. But okay, I don't want to give you a wrong impression. So 4 is certainly maybe good to study the Laughlin states, but for other states like non-abelian states, we definitely need more than 4 particles. And so this leads us to this idea of matrix product states, which are a new step in how we can study these systems. So this is, of course, many people here have basically pushed and developed this field, so I will not give a very broad introduction to this, but just for those who are not so familiar. So the basic idea of matrix product states is that if you look at the full many-body Hilbert space of your system, then a generic state in that Hilbert space will have an entanglement entropy that scales as the volume of that subsystem. But the physically interesting states, as we saw on the previous slides, they have entanglement entropy that only scales as a boundary of the subsystem. So these physically relevant states are special, in at least from this entanglement point of view. And that can be used to our advantage. So because they have less entanglement than generic states, then we can find simpler building blocks for these states. So DNA is for a human body. So for these physically interesting states, we can find out, and in 1D systems, we can find that there are matrices that but just by stacking these matrices in a kind of array, we can get a very accurate representation of our state. And in higher dimensions, you of course have to generalize this, but the basic idea is the same. So why is this interesting and useful? Well, first of all, it's useful practically because you see, if this is my full many-body state, so in terms of all slated determinants in my Hilbert space, then I need to find these coefficients, and finding these coefficients, there's a cost of 2 to the n if these are spins 1/2 or something like that. So there's exponential cost. However, if I have these matrices, and if these matrices are not ridiculously big, then then my many body wave function is just given as a product over these matrices. So the cost is basically linear if these matrices do not explode. So there's a great numerical efficiency if we can work with these matrices. And the other nice thing is that physical properties can be computed directly from these matrices, and I will give you an example how we do that. So I will give you an example how we construct this MPS description for these quantum Hall states. And so the basic idea, which was realized by Duncan in the early 80s, is that we can, if we start from the full Coulomb interaction projected to a Landau level, we can expand that in a kind of series of shorter range interaction. And the first term of such an expansion is just the derivative of the delta function, because that's the shortest range interaction between two fermions in a Landau level. So this first term of such an expansion is called the V1 Haldane pseudopotential. And the interesting thing about that Hamiltonian V1 is that if you diagonalize it at 1/3 filling factor, you find that it has a unique zero energy mode, and that mode is the Laughlin state. And then if you turn on these higher order terms, you just adiabatically evolve to the full Laughlin state. So this is the kind of way to get analytic handle on this Laughlin state. So we want to study this V1 Hamiltonian in this talk, but that is still complicated, because even this V1, when you project it to a Landau level, it's still a long-range interaction. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to look at the individual matrix element of that Hamiltonian between the single particle states, because this enters the, this is the, really the Hamiltonian. And so the interesting thing is that if you work on a cylinder, I told you that the one-body wave functions are Gaussian localized along the cylinder. But the thing that actually controls, so these orbitals can move around along that direction, and that's controlled just by this parameter 2 pi over L, which is, L is the perimeter of the cylinder. So now if I look at this matrix element here, I see that if this L becomes small, so these orbitals are very far away from each other, I'm going to kill all the copying terms in my Hamiltonian. So essentially, you know, there will be just density-density interactions between this without any hopping if kappa becomes really big. So the basic idea will be to kind of seek an expansion of this V1 interaction in terms of this parameter kappa. And that's what I'm going to do here. So this is how it works out. You will see that if this parameter kappa becomes very large, then you can actually analytically fully solve this Hamiltonian V1. And then we are going to increase kappa to kind of go to the more physical limit. So okay, so let's do this. So we have this cylinder, we have these orbitals that are spaced by this parameter kappa. And the first order expansion of this V1 Hamiltonian contains just two types of terms. So this slide is going to look ugly, but the physical point is that these are just density-density interactions. So this first term prevents me to put two particles in two orbitals next to each other. And then the second term prevents me to have to put them in two orbitals and have an empty orbital between them. So that's a really simple Hamiltonian. It has a ground state, which is a single-sided determinant, and it's just, you know, 1, 0, 0, 1. You know, here I come to the patterns that I promised to talk about. So this ground state of this Hamiltonian is a single-sided determinant, so it's very simple. It has entanglement entropy, which is 0, because it's a product state, and it's a 0 mode of this Hamiltonian, and it's also 0 mode of the full Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's not so interesting, but now let's try to increase this perimeter of the cylinder to make it a little bit fatter. So then these orbitals come closer together, and I get two more terms in the expansion. Okay, so this term is also quite simple. It's also a density-density interaction term. So it just prevents having an electron, two empty orbitals, and another electron. Okay, but this term is more interesting. So now this is a real hopping term. So this term tells me that I can take two particles which are next to one another, and I can hop them to the next orbitals. So I can hop them outwards to the next orbitals, or I can have a conjugate process as well. So how about this Hamiltonian? This looks slightly more complicated, but actually I can also completely solve analytically this Hamiltonian as well. So the ground state of this full Hamiltonian, so this plus that, is this first slated determinant that I found here. And then times plus another slated determinant. So actually not just one, but a lot of them. So this slated determinant, I got it from, you know, taking this slated determinant, and wherever I have 1, 0, 0, 1, I just do this hop to 0, 1, 1. And there is some numerical coefficient in front of it that depends on kappa. So this many-body state is also a zero mode of the Hamiltonian, and you can show that because this Hamiltonian can be written as a positive semi-definite operator. So there's some technical reason why you can do that. I will not go into this, but you can believe me that you can do it from here. And then the interesting thing is that now this state, this combination of patterns has some life to it. It's not completely dead like this one, so it becomes entangled. And now we are going to rewrite it in an MPS form. So if you study this state, you can see that there are only three kinds of configurations that can appear in these slated determinants. And then I can just map them to, for example, spin one chain. You can think of it in that way. And so in this basis, I can rewrite this state as a product of matrices where this matrix A is given by, you know, you can explicitly verify this. And then you can show that the entanglement entropy of that state is no longer zero. So we build in some entanglement by this hopping process. And this is something that you can actually continue now to higher orders, and you can also do it very generically for a number of these states. So what? This is for fermions, right? This is for fermions, right? But the, yeah, I don't know if there's some deep meaning in the spin language behind this. I just use it kind of illustratively here. But you can do it for fermions. You can do it for bosons. So it doesn't matter. So now let's see what we can do with this. Why is this useful? So how do I compute physical properties now that I have this MPS? So if this was my state, which I wrote as a product of these matrices, then, you know, if that was a ket, then a bra is just kind of using A daggers, essentially. And so the norm can simply, you know, in this graphical notation, can be computed just by essentially multiplying A and A dagger and summing it up. So then if I want to compute, for example, some observable, like an occupation, average occupation number of some orbital, of any orbital in my state, then what I need to do, I just need to take this, and at location M, I essentially need to insert an operator, which is this occupation, or in the spin language is just SZ operator, and then of course I divide it by the norm. So this can be worked out, it's fairly straightforward, and when you do it, you get these orbital occupancies as a function of the number of orbital, and there you see that actually this state is kind of a charge density wave. So it's not yet a liquid state because this first order hopping is not enough to melt the crystal. So I would need to include higher order hoppings in order to completely get a uniform density state in the bulk. And that can be done either by continuing this expansion or by using conformal field theory, which I will not talk about right now. But if you do it to higher orders, then you can compute, for example, a pair correlation function as a function of distance on the cylinder. And you find that this pair correlation indeed looks like a liquid state. So it saturates, you know, to a constant. It doesn't have these oscillations that a Wigner crystal would have. The other thing you can compute is an entanglement entropy as a function of the cylinder perimeter. And there you discover that there is a nice area law. So the entanglement entropy scales linearly with the perimeter. And there is this constant subleading term, which you can find to be you know, the logarithm of the quantum dimension. And of course, here you can see also that, so these different symbols are for different orders of the expansion. So if you keep a small order, that will eventually break down. So you will not be able to get area law. So then you have to go to higher order to continue recovering the area law. Okay, so what's next? So there are three elements to this game. So the first element, level one, that's ED, exact dimerization. So we've been doing that since 1980s, and incredible amount of insight was obtained using that. So we know how to do that. Now we also know how to compute MPS analytically for a large class of these model states. And then this third level is what we really want to do. So we now want to find a variational procedure that works in the basis of these MPSs. And of course, that's very well known. It's a density matrix normalization group. So that presumably will allow us to treat Coulomb interactions and other generic types of interactions that arise in these systems. So this is something that's, I guess, work in progress. Some work has been done, but this is still what needs to be kind of set up to become a household tool to study these systems. So how am I doing with time? Okay, so why do we want to do all this? So I think the crucial issue why we need something beyond ED in these systems is to study, to understand the role of Landau level mixing in these systems. So normally what people do to describe the system is they consider just a partially filled Landau level and assume that there are no excitations to other Landau levels in the system. But that's not in reality the case, because these other Landau levels are not so far away, and particles can be excited to these states, to these Landau levels as well. So, and this is extremely important, especially for the non-abelian states. So we really need to have a tool that can enable us to study these systems. And you see, the problem with studying this by ED is just that your Hilbert space grows incredibly faster. So you need something better than ED. So now I'm going to tell you, in the remainder of time, I'm going to tell you about the quantum Hall effect in bilayer graphene, which is a system that where you cannot neglect this Landau level mixing. So it's a system where you really need to study this multiple Landau level excitations. You have to include them from the beginning. So just very briefly, so bilayer graphene, you have two sheets of graphene in a Bernal stacking. And so this system has a very simple low energy effective description in terms of 2x2 Hamiltonian, which has a parabolic dispersion, as you all probably know. In magnetic field, you just promote this momentum to a harmonic oscillator raising operator, and then you can find the Landau level structure. So you find that Landau levels have this dispersion that goes essentially like for parabolic systems. And Landau levels have degeneracies. So there is a special level, which is the n equals 0 and 1. So that level has zero energy. And it has a degeneracy, it has a multiplicity of 8, and all the other levels have multiplicity of 4, which comes just from the usual spin and valley degrees of freedom in bilayer graphene, similarly like in graphene. So what are the novel aspects of fractional quantum Hall effect that are going to occur in the system? Well, there are two most important features that we need to consider here. What I mentioned already, that Landau levels have multiple degeneracies, so valley, spin, and also, valley spin, and also this special orbital degeneracy, 0 and 1. That's just for the zeroth level, which is what interests us now. The second thing is that Coulomb interaction is screened compared to, for example, gallium arsenide, where that's not so crucial. So instead of just 1 over k, which is the 2D Fourier transform of Coulomb, now you have some additional terms, which you can evaluate, for example, in RPA. It's not really crucial. To be exact about this, it's not that sensitive to that. So how are we going to model this? Well, this first thing is difficult, this multiple degeneracies of Landau levels. So we are going to assume that the strong interactions in bilayer graphene lift this degeneracy, at least partially. And this has been studied a lot in the context of integer quantum Hall states, where it also plays a role. So we're going to assume that the interactions lift this degeneracy between, between valleys and spins. So, but we are going to keep this orbital 0 and 1 degeneracy. So our theoretical model just has these two levels, which are actually very close to one another, so they are nearly degenerate. And as you see, because you have such a model with two Landau levels, then you have a symmetry that emerges in your problem. So the states at nu and nu equal 2 will match necessarily because of this. And you can treat this as our assumption, but also this is consistent with the recent experiments. So for example, these Jacobi experiments, they do see that, for example, third states, they follow such patterns. All right, so this is 5 minutes total, or 5 minutes? Oh, okay, so I can take it slower. Okay, good. So you can treat this as assumption in our model, but as I said, it does have some support in experiments too. So there are three questions that I want to now address in this model. So first I want to see generically what kind of fractions I can expect to be realized in such a system. Then I will show you that, if I have time, that the collective excitations can be quite different in this bilayer graphene system compared to, for example, two-component semiconductor systems like quantum Hall bilayers. And finally, I would like to address the possibility for having even denominator states and this non-abelian anions in these systems. So this has actually, in even denominator states, has been observed in one of the experiments that I showed at the beginning. So what fractions are stable? So the first point, so how do we attack this? So first, remember I told you that the interaction can be just parameterized by these Haldane pseudopotentials, but now the catch here is because we have two levels, then we have not just one type of pseudopotentials, but in fact 16 possible types, because you know two particles can scatter in all possible ways between these two levels. So we have these 16 Haldane pseudopotentials, so it's already kind of really complicated. And if you don't have any screening, so here are all of them. So I plotted all of them. And as you see, it's a big mess. So there are all kinds of, you cannot really neglect anything, right? It's really complicated. Now, screening actually helps a little bit to clean up this mess. So if you look at strong screening limit, then actually a lot of these pseudopotentials kind of die out. And then you can even try to perturbatively study some questions. Yeah.
So when you say screening, you just find a dielectric constant,
is that right? So it's exactly this. So it's virtual excitations, you know, between empty and filled levels that
so
renormalize.
The long range part is just modified by some finite dielectric
constant. So basically, if the screening is strong, you get some logarithmic type of flattening of your potential. That's what it is. But in any case, so in the simulations, we will just take all the pseudopotentials. We will not try to kind of eliminate some of them because, you know, we can just do all of them. So why not? So how do we determine what fractions are stable? So this is a really old method that comes from, the first papers on the quantum Hall effect. So you just look at the ground state energy versus filling factor, and you look for cusps in this dependence of the ground state energy on the filling factor. So that signals you the discontinuity in the chemical potential, and that's where you expect the quantum Hall states. And so in this old work, you see that happens for 1/3 and 2/5, and so, and those are the two main fractions in gallium arsenide. So we've done the same thing for bilayer graphene. So it's ground state energy versus filling factor. And so there are a couple of states that we see here. So there's this nu equal -1 state, which is incredibly robust. And then the next one is -4/3, which is also the most stable one according to the experiments. So we seem to kind of agree on that. And then, of course, there are also some fifth states that kind of appear to emerge here and there, but they're much more difficult to study numerically, so we cannot conclusively say if they're or not. We cannot estimate gaps and stuff like that. So there are a couple of states that we do see in this model. And now, okay, so there is also interesting stuff about the collective modes, but I would think I will just skip that, and you can ask me about that if you have time. So let me tell you about this even denominator states, because that's what interests everybody. So first, I'm going to present you three pieces of evidence for the non-abelian state in this bilayer graphene. So first, I'm going to look at the average populations of this level 0 and 1. So I'm going to look at how many particles on average are in one layer, in one sublevel opposed to the other sublevel. So these are the two sublevels. And if I'm interested in half filling, then there are two possibilities. So if you think in terms of holes, then I have -1/2 and a 3/2 possibility. So here I plot these average occupations, and I do a finite size scaling as a function of total number of particles. So I see that for this nu equal 3/2 state, as I go to larger systems, the occupation of one of the levels actually goes to 0. So that's the occupation of this level that goes to 0. So all the particles tend to sit just in this 0 sublevel for this filling factor. And now for the other filling factor, I actually, what I see is that now both levels are occupied, but this zero level has twice as many particles as one. So what that means is that this zero level is nearly completely filled, and this level one is now half filled. Okay, so that's the first indication, because we know that in gallium arsenide, if level one is half filled, that's the Moore Reed state. Okay, but now we can do so. That's a good piece of news. So because you see, this one would not work for the Moore Reed state, because this level zero, that's a compressible state. So there's no way that this can be incompressible. So that's the first piece of evidence. The second piece of evidence, so we're going to look at the effect of screening by assuming that this zero level is completely filled. And so we just look at this piece belonging to the one level. So I project my exact state to this level one, and I look at the overlap with this Moore Reed state as a function of screening. And you see that there is some intermediate regime where this overlap is enhanced quite a bit compared to zero screening. Now, of course, we don't know exactly what value screening has in real experiments, but we expect it to be strong, so it's somewhere in that regime here. And the third piece of evidence, so because you have this two-component, two-level system, then you might expect that there are also two-component states, Kohn-Hall two-component states that describe the ground state and not this Moore-Reed state. So what do I mean by that? So that's known from a long time ago in gallium arsenide. So if I have two layers of a bilayer system with two layers, and I make a Laughlin state in one layer, a Laughlin state in another layer, and I couple them by a single slated determinant, then I get a state which is a total filling factor 1/2. And this state is called the Halperin 331 state. So this state is incompressible, but unfortunately it's abelian. So it's a contender for a half-filled ground state, but that's not what we want. And that state has been observed a long time ago in gallium arsenide bilayers. So could that state be actually the ground state now in our bilayer graphene system? Well, it cannot be, because this state actually requires you to have a population balance between these two levels. So you need to have the same number of particles here and the same number of particles there. If you allow some fluctuations between these numbers, you quickly kill this state. So because we've seen that on this figure, that we have a large difference in population between these two levels, then there's no way we can have 331. But we have, of course, also checked, you can check overlap, for example, and you find that the overlap is pretty bad. So this state is not good. So just to recapitulate about the experiments, so these two experiments, what they seem to suggest is that the states do obey this new plus two symmetry, which is integrated in our model. So that's a good thing. The second thing is that it seems that the strongest fraction in the system is -4/3, which also agrees with what we see. And also, this experiment has observed this stated nu equal -1/2 that we identify as the one which is as the one among the half-filled states that is robust, incompressible, and we also claim it's non-abelian. But of course, one would need further experiments to confirm this. And so I would like to emphasize, so where do we go from here? Well, in particular, there's this one obvious thing, which I believe people are already trying. So if you have this bilayer graphene and in a magnetic field, you can also put the electric field. You can also apply electric field. And then you modify this effective Hamiltonian by opening a gap. So now there is a new parameter that you have in your system, which is the ratio of that gap to the magnetic length. And you can ask, for example, the question, because now you have the possibility to tune the interaction. So what's going to happen if I sweep this parameter across some range? And in these papers, we actually studied that. So you can show that for the experimentally relevant values of that parameter, you can sweep between these different kinds of states, basically staying at the fixed filling factor, which is not possible in gallium arsenide, because these states are realized in different Landau levels in gallium arsenide. So this feature with the electric field, I think, will tell us a lot more about these systems, and will give us new information about you know, transitions between different states, and also see, we can see, for example, if we can make this non-abelian state more stable by tuning the gap in this way, and so on. And so, yeah, so those are the things I wanted to tell you about. I just would like to conclude by thanking all my collaborators, and especially Dima for a lot of work on graphene we did together, and also Duncan, who is in the audience, about we worked a lot about this Landau mixing and non-abelian states and so on. Thank you.
There's a minus one half states observed, and also minus three half states also observed.
Right. So if you think in terms of these two levels,
yeah.
So let's just, you know, count. We can also think, so if this one is completely filled and this one is half filled,
yeah.
That's like three half, right? Or in terms of holes.
So this one stronger than the minus one half, I mean, experimentally.
No, this is the minus one half experimentally. It depends how you are going to count.
So
the.
This is a minus
so this is the one. This is the one that's observed.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So there is this thing which seems to be kind of inert, but I think it's going to play an important role for the excitations, for example, because excitations will be different. They will be strongly affected.
So
the
density population, maybe let me question. Whether there is a nearby state where density is about the same, my question really results how you potentially result, whether the calculation has a bias against some population.
No, it doesn't.
Or it's just a So this is a really long thing.
Well, no, there is no, you don't put any bias, so anything could come out of. So for example, a 331 state, right?
Yeah,
that would have an equal of both, right?
That's fine.
But that one is simply not not realized for, you know, types of interactions that. So there is no SU2 symmetry here, because the one body orbital, so these orbitals here have a character of n equals zero Landau level in gallium arsenide. And these have n equal one. So they have different form factors, and the system does not have full SU2 symmetry. There is at least nothing that seems to be broadly kind of known as such a contender. But of course, you could construct plenty of states. But
experimentally, what is the energy gap in this state?
I'm not sure if we should really believe that at this point, because these are still very fragile samples, and I mean, it is. I don't. Do you know how it compares to fourth third state? I don't know. No, no, no.
These are four terminal measurements, so not two terminal, but in some other experiments. So they actually have a way of at least estimating that.
But out of the two experiments, only one so far sees this even denominator. The other experiment, the Jacobi experiment, does not claim to see it.
All right, that's all the questions. Let's